The Envelope is brought to you by Hulu.
He is better at staying in the moment. Like, he's extremely present. And I am, like, thinking about the future. It sort of mirrored what we were doing as our characters in terms of planning. And I'd be like, you know, we have to shoot this scene tomorrow. He's like, what scene is that?
Hi, everyone. We're deep in the heart of Emmy season, which means we're back with the Envelope podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm one of your hosts, Yvonne Biarriel, and I'm here with my friends, Sean Finney and Mark Olson. Thanks
great
for joining
to see you.
Me.
Yes,
it's
we're back.
Been so long.
Did we leave?
No.
No, we've just been in this room.
The whole been time. In this room. And look, I know what you guys are thinking. Emmys, again, didn't we just do this?
Yes.
But the ceremony in January was actually a result of delays from the dual writers and actors strike. So this is actually the ceremony for this year. And, you know, there's been some contraction in the television space, but that doesn't make, you know, the task of going through the shows any less overwhelming. It's still a massive list of shows.
Yes.
But Sean, I'm curious, you know, you're well-versed in the film space and the film awards season. How does this feel different for you?
It feels very different. It feels, I mean, honestly, you kind of alluded to it, where it just feels like a longer list, a more expanded list of content to get through. And obviously, with the shows kind of being overlapping each other didn't really help. But also, what's interesting is I'm so used to like a, I don't want to say proper award season, but I'm so used to the gambit of festivals and how that goes into like the official award season. This feels just kind of like it's happening in the ecosystem. And then from an administrative standpoint, I can't help but think about it. You know, when you think about the Film Academy, it's 11,000 plus members around the world, about 24 different categories, and about 19 different disciplines within the organization. This, I believe, has like 24,000 plus members, 40 plus categories, and about 31 different disciplines that the 30 plus different disciplines that the body represents. So from an administrative standpoint, it is almost as equal to how expansive it is to me from just getting through the content. And so I'm like, I'm so glad that we're doing this together so I can share. So
I mean, you made all that feel like an SAT question. Like, I don't know if I can keep up with the numbers, but Mark, how are you feeling?
Well, for me, as you know, someone who's more versed in the movie world, like the thing that is confusing, Sean, I think you're just saying, is how award season to me means festivals, all these other award shows kind of leading up to it. And it's so interesting to me how even like the Golden Globes, the SAG Awards, some of these other award shows that do give out television awards are still essentially in the runway to the Oscars. And so there isn't really events or aren't like, you know, stops along the way on our way to the Emmys. So it's just like, we're doing this, all the talent is out there doing their FIC events and everything, and then the Emmys happen. Like, there's not going to be as much buildup, and I think, I don't know how you feel, but like, it seems like it also makes, for better or for worse, the horse race aspect of this, of like, who's really competing? Who's like really got a shot here? Who should we really be talking about? Or who are we overlooking?
Right.
Like, that feels much more, in some ways, like just up to journalists and what they're going to be covering. And so it makes the whole process feel a little more amorphous to me.
That's why it's so hard, like, to get like new shows in the mix, because it is easier to go off what we know, at least on the voter side, I would imagine. You know, this year we've lost Succession, we've lost Better Call Saul, and then, you know, some of the shows that were regularly in contention, like The White Lotus, you know, they didn't have new seasons during this time. So it does leave a little bit of room for new shows like Mr. and Mrs. Smith or whatever. And, you know, we've lost a few comedies. So it will be interesting who gets sort of in the mix. And, you know, we talked earlier, too, about like the blurring of categories and what can, you know, be considered a drama or
series.
Comedy. Yeah.
Yeah.
How are you feeling about that?
I mean, I'm just glad that there's a comedy category. So I'll just say that. I'm just glad there's a comedy category. But for me, it's interesting because you're like, what is the defining, kind of like what I think you're alluding to, like, even like eligibility, where it's like, what is this eligible for? Mm-hmm. And then who gets to decide and when does that change? Mm-hmm. But to me, I'm getting used to all of these categories. This is my honest answer. But Mark, one of the things I thought you mentioned that was great is the SAG Awards, the Golden Globes, and you think about the Oscars, you kind of feel like that prediction list that you start to see culminating and just going around is different. But also film, because for film to qualify, it has to be in the theater. Mm-hmm. And so there's still sometimes a community experience where you're able to see how other people are reacting. But for TV, for me, it's more a singular experience. Mm-hmm. And so that's also been interesting.
And you're committing more time to that singular experience. I mean, I know some movies go 3 hours now, but with, you know, TV shows, you're still dedicating 8 hours, 10 hours of your life to it if you're doing it right.
Yes, if you're doing it right.
If you're doing it right. But, you know, with our next few episodes, we got a lot of great contenders that are in the running. And Mark, why don't you talk to us about who you spoke with this week?
I talked to Maya Erskine, one of the stars of Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And, you know, having kind of first broken through playing an awkward teenage version of herself in the semi-autobiographical Pen 15, this is a very different Maya Erskine and Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Here she's like this very capable, stylish, sexy, like secret agent who takes on a new job, and she's paired with a partner played by Donald Glover, who's a co-creator of the show. And, you know, they begin as a professional relationship that becomes a more personal relationship. And it's really interesting how the show, you know, it begins similar to the movie that it's based on as this kind of, you know, examination of a marriage and what relationships are like. But then the show also, like, has a lot to say just about, like, people's relationship to work and what, like, it's like having a job in the contemporary economy. And so, like, I think the show and Maya's performance in particular was, like, a real surprise.
And I'm glad they made it a series, and they continue to evolve, like, who the characters can be and how reflective of the world that actually is. But to your point, like, they talk about, like, okay, when are we cutting off work? We're having dinner right now. We can't be talking about, but then their phone goes off and they have to be a part of it. So, yeah, I loved it.
Sean, tell us who you spoke with.
I spoke with Viet Thanh Nguyen and Don McKellar, who are two of the three creative forces behind The Sympathizer. And Viet is a Pulitzer Prize winner, and I think it's actually just really nice having the author whose content it was adapted from really be a part of the experience. He's an executive producer, too. So I got to speak to him about that and what that was like. Obviously, Don McKellar has been a part of this game for a while, but The Sympathizer is really about a communist in South Vietnam, and it's really based on loyalty, identity, and more importantly, I think we've always seen the Vietnam War from a very Western lens. We've always seen every example of what that was, but we got to see it from the Vietnamese experience, and I think that that was really, really cool. And they talked about how it was so important for him to make sure they had Vietnamese representation, authentic representation on there too. So it was really, really good, and I love hearing more how things happen on set.
After this break, we'll get into Mark's conversation with Maya Erskine.
For the Los Angeles Times and The Envelope, I'm Mark Olson, and I'm here today with Maya Erskine, one of the stars of Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
On the show, your sort of employer always opens all their messages with hi, hi, and you begin referring to them as hi, hi. And I have to confess, watching the show, I began compulsively saying hi, hi, and I don't know if other people have had this response.
They have, actually. There have been multiple people. A lot of the crew members were saying hi, hi, when we would just be saying our salutations and be hi, hi. But yeah, but then it sort of tapered out by the end.
And now, you know, in remaking the 2005 movie, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, I think people expected for it to be sort of an examination of marriage. But one of the things that I think has made this version feel so fresh and really contemporary is it also is very much an examination of work and sort of like the gig economy and people having kind of transient jobs nowadays. And was that something that jumped out to you when you first were reading the script?
Not originally. I mean, I only got to see, really they only described it to me when I first was being talked to about it. And so the way that it was initially described was actually like a cross of scenes from a marriage and you know, Annie Hall. Like, it was actually, the focus was so much on the relationship. And so then as we were filming it and the scripts were being written, then I started to see like, oh yeah, it is showing this other side of work and these temporary jobs, and then also sort of what it's like to be in work with your spouse.
You got excited about that as it was like that part of it was coming out?
Yeah, and also like I knew where it was headed. Like, I knew what the goalposts were going to be, like, of the, you know, first time you date someone, the first time you go on a trip with them, and I knew that. But I feel like as they kept writing it and as we kept filming it, it would get deeper into the dynamics of what it means when the woman maybe is saving the man constantly, or doing a little bit better, or getting a promotion. How does that affect the relationship, and that was exciting to me.
And there's something really glamorous and sort of luxurious about the world of the show. In a lot of ways, and I know this has been some of the writing around the show has been about this too, that like it just highlights how like impossibly out of reach that is for many people and will be for most people. And again, was that something that you all were like talking about, or like how did you kind of respond to the sort of like the world that the show exists in?
Yeah, I mean, it was in the first moments of the pilot, you know, you're walking into this impossible to attain brownstone in New York, West Village, that, you know, I'll never step my foot into, and the closet and all these clothes, and even just the filming aspect of it for me felt like such a big, hard to attain place to be, because we were filming in Italy and like in the Alps, and we were filming in Lake Como, and it was just this like massive production and this really high production value. And it's just little old us like in these shots that are grand and sweeping. And so, yeah, it sort of started to mirror the actual like acting of it and the action of filming the show. But yeah, that was a true intention of Francesca and Donald and Hero when they were filming.
And your background is kind of in independent film, and on Pen 15 is kind of a scrappier show. What was it like just being, I mean, you've never quite, I think, worked on just a production at like this scale before.
Never. And I think what was really helpful for me is that I think even with Donald, you know, the way they've described working on Atlanta, it's like they weren't big budgets, you know? So it always felt like students coming together to like make their project and make something happen. And what I was so nervous of was when something is really big, you can sometimes lose touch with that sort of fire and that passion to like really make sure we get every shot that we want. And that was never gone. Like that, it was present from the whole time, from the beginning to the end. It was wild because I've talked about this before, but Fran, Hero, and Donald and I were like walking on the street on like one of the first days. It was in Tribeca. It was a night shoot. There were huge cranes, huge lights everywhere. And we were just like, this is for us. And so it felt like being a kid in a candy shop the whole time. But we never lost that drive, I'd say, to like really make it as specific and nuanced and as good as we possibly could.
Donald Glover, your co-star and the co-creator of this show, his public persona is very enigmatic. And
yeah.
I'm like curious what it's like for you to then meet him in a bit of a rush and in a lot of ways like get to know him through the course of making the show.
He surprised me so much because he's so easy to get along with. He's so warm and so down to earth and passionate. And I was definitely intimidated at first, but it worked out well because, you know, in the beginning of the show, we don't know each other. We're strangers. And so I think it lended itself really well to the chemistry of just getting to know each other. And we were kind of having our professional faces on in the beginning. But then as we were filming, there was so much modulating of like, how much are you revealing? How vulnerable are you getting with each other? And we were constantly playing with that. So at some point, Donald and I just started sharing embarrassing stories about ourselves to each other. And it was like, oh, okay, good. I can say that and we're good. We're good. Okay, good. And then it just like opened it up and we were like very, very good friends after that. So we got very close as it went on.
The characters of John and Jane like approach their work very differently. Jane is much more sort of planned out. She's almost administrative in a way. Mm-hmm. John is much more like improvisational and emotional. Mm-hmm. Does that describe you and Donald as well?
Like weirdly. Yeah, I do think he is better at staying in the moment. Like he's extremely present. And I am like thinking about the future constantly. I'm just like constantly like, all right, well, what's the scene tomorrow? So we're gonna do this scene and we're gonna skip. And I'm just like constantly thinking about, which isn't healthy, but that's how I operate. It sort of mirrored what we were doing as our characters in terms of planning and being organized. And I'd be like, you know, we have to shoot this scene tomorrow. He's like, what scene is that? But it was great. Like it worked. We balanced each other out. It was a good partnership.
And now, much of the, before the show came out, there was a lot of press around the fact that Phoebe Waller-Bridge had been attached to it and left the project, and then you came in. And how was the character, like, sort of reconfigured for you, or what sort of impact do you feel like you had on the character?
I don't know exactly how it was written before I came on, because they didn't share any scripts with me. So I wasn't, you know, I don't know, I can't speak to how it changed from that, but I do know that once I was involved, they asked me to, like, share stories of my relationships, insecurities, any quirks that could help infuse the character Jane with parts of myself more, but she still felt actually closer to the showrunner in a lot of ways. Like, the more I got to know the showrunner, I was like, oh, I feel like she's you, and I'm just, like, joining with you, and that, because it was from her voice, you know?
How so? Like what is it about the character of Jane that you think is like Francesca?
I don't want to say anything without getting into specifics about Francesca's life or her personal relationship, but there's things that are drawn from her relationship, from Donald's, a couple things from my relationships, past relationships, things about Fran, you know, just how incredibly strong she is. She's a little bit more vulnerable and able to express her emotions, I think, than Jane is in the beginning, but she can have a searing edge to her if she needs to. She's incredibly intelligent, but, like, I would say warmer than Jane.
And now both you and Donald are just incredible physical performers. And in particular, in, like, the finale and sort of like the house shootout, there's almost this, like, Looney Tunes aspect to it. And was that a way that felt like the two, you and Donald, connected? Was that you both seem to have this very sort of elasticine physicality?
So nice. I am a physical actor. Like, that is how I approach characters, is I have to come from the physicality first. And so actually in the beginning it was tough because we shot in order. So the first episode, it's a lot of, like, kind of stillness, and there's only, like, some running, but there's just, like, a lot of keeping your cards close to your chest, and how much do you reveal, how much do you not reveal. And that's really hard for me because I'm not good at lying and I want to express everything all the time. And I'm an overshare. For the final episode, when we finally get to, like, really release all of it, you know, Donald and I just had so much fun with it. I was very sick, though, when we were shooting the fighting scenes. And so I would say, like, I was obsessed with fighting and stunts, and I was like, just put me in, and he'd be like, no, like, this isn't, you're not doing it right, like, some somersaults or certain things I didn't have the energy for, but we still did it, and I would say that if we were to do another season, I would want to involve more physicality.
Is there a distinction between physical comedy and, like, physical action, like stunt work? Like, are those kind of the same, or is there something distinct about them?
That's a good question. I mean, yeah, I think there's differences. I mean, I think there's just the thing with both of it is it's just being aware of your body and being present in your body. And so if you can do that, then it's sort of like it's a malleable instrument that you're just using in different ways. And I think with physical comedy, it's like, the intention is never to, like, be funny with your body. It's sort of like, I'm just doing this thing of my instinct or whatever, and I'm playing this character, and this is coming out right now, but it's not like, let me do a funny move. It's more just, I think, for me at least, this is how my body is manifesting whatever I'm feeling inside. like, I'm just thinking of even, because Maya from Pen 15 is, like, an extremely physically wild character, and I feel like for that was just like me remembering what it was like to be 13 and letting that play out, like not stopping the instinct from happening.
Because the show has this kind of real casual sexiness to it, and I'm thinking there's a scene where the two of you are at a farmer's market, and like you're wearing just like sort of like a slip dress with like a shirt over it, and like Donald has like a couple buttons too many unbuttoned. And like that aspect of the show is one of the things that makes it like really appealing and like a very fun hang, I think. And were you like, did you get really involved like in the costuming and what Jane was going to wear?
There was a lot of back and forth in the beginning of deciding what her look was going to be. I mean, we had like a lot of references of Jane Birkin and kind of going in that direction, but then sometimes going more masculine. And yes, it was always just a constant conversation. But I think the goal was always for like simplicity. Like simplicity and ease is what can be very sexy, not like these sculpting, you know, bustiers or what you think of when you think the word sexy.
This is a podcast, a video podcast.
Yes.
But people maybe can see the fact that you are currently pregnant.
Yes.
And I'm curious, it's such a big story point on the show. There's so many conversations about whether to have a baby or not. I know this is your second child. But did that somehow crystallize your thinking or your feeling on this topic? It's so curious that, like, coming along as it is, you know, when it
yeah.
is.
Yeah. I mean, no, I think I always knew I wanted to have more kids. And so when filming it, it was more just about the challenge of having to represent the other side in the fight, you know, of just, I don't want kids, and trying to get in that mindset of what that feels like, and just trying to, you know, she comes up with reasonable justifications for why she doesn't want to have kids. In my mind, though, I think she does want to have kids deep down. She just thinks that it's not the smartest timing in this job.
Because that is one of the things that's so interesting, again, in the distinctions that are drawn between John and Jane.
Yeah.
Is she has like a much more sort of conventional ambition. Like
yeah.
she wants to like move up the ladder.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really.
Well, I think also it's the family that he grew up in and the family she grew up in. Mm. Like her, you know, parents, she doesn't have a warm relationship with the one surviving parent, her father. She doesn't have sort of this model to go off of like a healthy family life. And she lost her mother when she was young. So in her mind, she's like, all I need is really just this cat and a job and money, and then I'll be fine, and then I'll run off, and I don't need you, I don't need anyone. Like, that's sort of her armor and her way to survive in life. And so I think adding a kid is just like, that would be this huge foreign, you know, object in her mode of life, her mode of thinking, how she survives, that she can't even like fathom bringing that in this moment, in this time being. But yeah, I think that John is someone who, you know, he still talks to his mom every day, and he wants to have, I think he's here because he wants to have the nice life. He wants to have the house. He'd be happy being the lower risk, you know, what are we calling it? The lower risk of high, just so that he could be able to come home every night, cook dinner, have a kid, put them to bed, like just live the all-American life. Mm-hmm. And that's not enough for her, I think, in her mind.
Donald's mother plays his mother
yeah.
on the show. And curiously, your mother played your mother on Pen 15. What is the energy like on set on like a mom day? Like,
it's really fun. I mean, she was great. Beverly's great. She made it so easy. And it just brings a warmth and shows another dimension to whoever's parent it is. So you get to see this other side of Donald, how he acts with his mom. And it's very sweet. For me, I feel like I was like such a brat and a child around my mom. When she would go, I'd be like, "Mom, it's continuity. You can't hold your bag now like that. Like, God." But I love having family on set, and it was a very family oriented show because we all had kids.
And now, as we're recording this, coming up is going to be the Tribeca Film Festival, and your husband, Michael Ungaretti, has a film, Sacramento, that's premiering there that you're in. Mm-hmm. And now, as I understand it, the two of you met, talk through the process of making this movie.
Yeah, well, we met actually, so I hadn't even met him. This was years ago. He had offered me a part in it. And then I said yes, because I was a fan of the script and of his work. And then we didn't meet for like months. And then finally we had a meeting, and then just kept kind of hanging out, and the movie didn't get made till after we had a kid and we're together. So, but what's crazy is that the movie is about us meeting and having a kid, and then it actually happened.
But it must be wild that like the specter of this movie, it, like, I would imagine, like, represents like a definite like chapter in your relationship, and like the fact that this movie is actually now like done and soon to be in the world, like, I'm just so curious, like, what that does for the two of you. It's almost like you're like in a new phase of life.
It's a really touching, beautiful part of our life. I mean, it's really like, it was so lovely making the film. It was so nice, you know, when he did the buyer's screening, actually. I don't know if I can talk about that, but it was on our son's birthday. And like, it was just that there were just so many like moments that we would look at each other like, wow, this brought us together. This is our family. This is our life now. And he did such a beautiful job directing it and making it. And I'm just so proud of him.
And now to get back to talking about the show, did you have like a map, or how did you sort of determine the extent to which Jane and John had like a real relationship at any point in the show? Because it does seem like at first they're sort of play acting as a couple because that's their job, but then it quickly becomes a real relationship. There's a one scene in particular after he's like been out in the snow, the bathtub scene, where you say, you know, I really, really care for you. And like the emphasis of like the two reallys was to me very emotional and like really startling. And I'm just curious, like, for you, like, how did you kind of decide like how much she did or didn't care for him, or really was or was not in the relationship at any moment?
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that episode we filmed actually at the end of the whole series. That was the one that was, you know, out of order the most. So we were, like, very comfortable with each other by that point. And that scene in particular, I'm so glad you mentioned it, that came from a real moment that happened between Donald and his wife when there was that sort of defining scene of, wow, I know, but I really, really care about you. Like, it's frightening, and I don't like how much I care about you. It was tough to sort of figure out how close they get, how fast, because we are jumping in time. And so I was always very careful about wanting to make sure I wasn't either exposing too much or being too intimate. Sometimes we would have too much chemistry and it would seem like we're a couple already, but we're just starting. Like, what is it like when you first get in a relationship with someone? What is it like when you travel with someone and you fart in front of them for the first time, or they see you brushing your teeth and all of these intimacies? For me, that was my favorite part of the filming, was just finding all of those like nuanced moments and those touchstones. And yeah, when we filmed that scene in particular, I remember we did the rehearsal and it was like very emotional during the rehearsal, and then it was like, all right, okay, we'll film it. But it's such a sweet way for Jane to like expose that she actually really cares about this person and likes him.
As genuine and emotional as the show can be, it also is extremely credible as just like a fun action show.
For sure.
And the Lake Cuomo scene, you know, episode in particular with Ron Perlman, like, in particular, the whole sort of like chase sequence where you're like up and down, a lot of stairs. And what was it like shooting that sequence?
That was hard. No, I mean, it was great. It's wild how action scene sequences, how you have to film them and how many times. And if you're in a car, that you can shoot a car four different times. So you're shooting in a real car with someone driving on top and controlling it, or you're shooting on a stage, or you're shooting on, there's like so many times you're filming it, so it can feel very mechanical and exhausting, but it's also, for me, freeing, because sometimes it's nice to not have to think at all in a lot of ways, and you're just in your body. So I loved it, and I love Ron Perlman so much. He's amazing.
As much as the show is very much focused on the characters of John and Jane, on you and Donald, there was just astonishing deep bench of supporting players that come through. And what was that experience like? That, like, you know, one day at work, it's like, you know, Ron Perlman or Sarah Paulson or Parker Posey and Wagner Moura. Like, what was it like having those supporting players coming through?
It's all my favorite actors. It's all my heroes. I'm just like, great, thank you. This is so nice. I mean, it's one thing to have watched them all, you know, like I've watched so many of their movies and shows. And so then when you actually get to be in person with them, acting opposite them and getting to see their process live, it's such a treat. It was And I thought I would be terrified and not be able to hold my own or act with them, that I would just like hide in a corner. But they're so warm and inviting that it was just like, just felt like actors just working together, easy.
Do you feel like you learned anything? Like, can you steal anything from Parker Posey?
I love how she just goes into it. Like, I love that she's not very precious in between. She's kind of just like talking and we're just hanging out, and then all of a sudden can just like sort of jump in. But the energy, her energy is always really up and really, she just gives something different every time. So, I mean, that's what I saw, and that's what I try to do, yeah.
And now you mentioned the possibility of a second season, and I've heard you in some other interviews having to be somewhat politely evasive on this question. What can you or can you not say? Because I've heard you say that you know some things.
And
you can't say that to a group of journalists.
I'm sorry. I'm not good at that. I mean, they could change it, though. I don't know. They could change whatever they told me. I think it's going to be even better than the first. That's what I would say. It's very exciting what they have in store.
The way the show ends on such a kind of ambiguous note, were you surprised by that ending, or what do you make of the ending that they, you know, they may or may not have made it out of this panic room, one of them may have survived?
Like, I loved that ending. I love it. I mean, I love the also seeing the shots outside, the way they described it to me, it was like heaven for me. Fran had described this once, where Francesca Sloan, the showrunner, she said, it depends how you look at life. Like, if you're glass half full or glass half empty, how do you look at it? Maybe they both survive, or maybe one survives. Maybe just Jane survives. Maybe just Donald survives. John, I mean. So I have my own feelings of what I think happened, but it might not coincide with what is going to happen in the second season. But I think it's a brilliant ending. I loved it.
So are you a glass half full or glass half empty kind of person?
Oh man, I am a glass half empty kind of person, but I also thought this was only going to be one season, if I'm going to be honest. Like, I really did think it was I thought it was a limited series. So I was like, oh, it's just one and done. So I thought that they both died, but I don't know what happened.
But it can't be the fact of the show, like, people want a second season.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that's what happened or that's not what did happen. I'm just saying that's where my mind went, but, yeah, I think Jane survives in that. Yeah.
I have to ask you, so in the course of the show, Jane, as you said, doesn't really have any family, just has this cat. And then in the final episode, the cat gets shot in a firefight. I myself have a cat. I'm ridiculously attached to my cat. Aww. And so that's messed up. You can't do that.
But it wasn't him. But she thought it was. But yeah, it's crossing a line. I know. It's dark. But it has to go to that place in order for them to hate each other that much, to want to kill each other. It has to get that dirty, I think.
Maya Erskine, thank you so much for joining us today. This has just been a terrific conversation.
Thanks for having me.
After the break, we'll have Sean's interview with Viet Thanh Nguyen and Don McKellar from The Sympathizer.
Thank you all for joining.
Thank you.
Yeah, we should start with you because it starts with you.
I would hope so.
Yeah, I would hope so too. It starts with you. I love the idea of you telling an honest global story to a global audience. And my question to you is two parts. A, did you think any of your books would be adapted? And did you think it would be this one?
Honestly, to A, no. Never.
Never?
Never, because I was telling a story that was going to be as honest as I possibly could make it and, you know, setting out to offend everybody.
Yeah.
But if any book was going to be adapted, it was going to be this one, because it was the way that people understand it is that it's a Vietnam War story. It's a lot more than that, but that's the book. And Americans have an obsession with the Vietnam War. And I think the reason why that's important is because even though it's an American story for Americans, because of Americans' power, it becomes a global story.
And your role into executive producing as well. I'm so curious of like how would you summarize your experience as an executive producer?
It's been surprisingly good, because I think I know how bad it can possibly get, but you know, working with people like Don was really amazing. the most important part about being an executive producer was just trying to get this show made in the first place, and then getting the right collaborators, because I knew I would have to turn the novel over to many other people. And so that was really crucial, to pick the right people so that I could trust their aesthetic and political visions about this story.
Don, I want to get into you, because you're no stranger to all sectors of entertainment: theater, writing, directing, producing, acting. I'm so curious how all of those elements specifically prepared you, because I feel like it gives you an advantage to really understand the nuances of a production. How did that really really impact the sympathizer in your experience?
Well, it's complicated. I don't know. I mean, I'm showrunner for this series, co-showrunning with Park Chan-wook. And it's true that I do feel that the acting, the writing, the directing, they all come into play in that job. I definitely felt I could empathize with the actors a little more.
Modulating some performances,
yeah,
maybe?
A little bit. And of course, the writing. And I mean, it all comes together, right? Because I'm also talking to the directors and trying to make a coherent sort of stylistic vision, you know. So I don't know. I think the background helped.
And I feel like, you know, we're so used to seeing this story, a version of the story told from a specific lens, a specific American Western lens. I really would love to understand the importance of really making sure that you're telling that global story honestly from a global perspective, specifically from the individuals that were impacted. That's for the both of you.
I mean, for me, the red line was that the story had to be about Vietnamese people with Vietnamese actors speaking as much of the Vietnamese language as we could possibly fit in there. If we were to do a show where, like, the actors were speaking English with a Vietnamese accent, no, I would have taken my name off of it. If we had a show with non-Vietnamese people playing Vietnamese roles, I would have taken my name off of it. If we had a show where the white guy was the absolute center of the story, would have taken my name off the show. So that was really, really crucial. And I think it's taken a long time for Hollywood to catch up with the global story, with people like me and the stories that I wanted to tell. So I think maybe there was a window of opportunity, and we seized it, basically, with this story with these actors.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest hook. It sounds crass to put it that way, but when you read the book, you think, oh, wow, I've really never seen it from this perspective. It's the Vietnam War took place in this country, but I've never seen it from a Vietnamese perspective, which is sort of amazing. And I do think it's a unique war, that we really feel we know what it was like over there because of basically American movies. And so it's immediately fascinating, at least it was to me, because I'm not Vietnamese and I've never thought of it that way. But at the same time, because it's a very good book, I could really get into it and understand it, and I felt a personal connection with it. So I thought, if I can help convey that very specific Vietnamese story to a global audience, I'm in. And yeah, I had the same conditions as Viet, absolutely. We didn't have to fight about that. It had to be Vietnamese people had to speak Vietnamese. It had to be Vietnamese actors, because that's what it's about.
And authentic to the story.
Yeah.
And I think even the best books, you know, might sell thousands of copies. But when you think about TV, film, and media, it has the span to reach millions. So I'd love to talk from, like, script, not even script, from book to script to production. And keeping the authenticity of the unique voice that is Captain, played by an incredible actor, and then your balance of bringing in, obviously, the elements of a production. So I would just love for you both to kind of talk about the authenticity of the character in the book, and then the authenticity of being able to share and showcase and merge that together.
I mean, obviously, I think a book is awesome.
Yeah. he's taking offense when you say
a book. Yeah. A book is awesome. Yeah. Just book.
Yeah. But honestly, when we were going to adapt it, I knew exactly what was going to happen, which is that everybody would go, oh my God, congratulations, yeah, it's going to be a TV show. I remember people saying that about the book when it was published. So I understand the reality of the media landscape and of the power of pop culture, especially in TV and movies. So there was a real responsibility on my part to try to get it as faithful to the novel as possible, but yet also allow the collaborators to realize their vision cinematically at the same time. So that was really important, and Don's been a good collaborator. I remember our first meeting at a hotel where we sat down and we discussed how are we going to turn this novel, break it down into however many episodes. And so we spent time talking about the story arc and however many episodes. And Don, I still haven't forgiven you.
You said seven episodes was the right number.
Yeah.
And I get paid per episode.
You're like, let's just make this ongoing. It never ends.
But then Don really took over as, obviously, the head writer, co-showrunner, assembled the writer's room. That was a really interesting process for me to see how he did that.
Yeah, I mean, it's of course scary adapting a book. It is. I'm impressed by. I'm sort of intimidated by that. I love the book, and it's impressive as a book. But on the other hand, as he said, that it's full of pop cultural references. It's full of really cinematic sequences, even in the book. So right away, I thought, okay, he's not going to be some stuffy writer who will poo-poo, you know, what ideas that come up that we think are cool cinematic ideas. That's part of it, because it's about storytelling. It's about how we've perceived the Vietnam War through stories. So if he wasn't open to that, we would have had a problem too. So, you know, that collaboration went both ways.
And I know the authenticity of it is so important and the integrity of it, but I believe that you were going to shoot in Vietnam, but ended up shooting in Thailand, was it? What was it like?
Oh, we tried to shoot it in Vietnam. Yeah. Definitely, we tried pretty hard, but we weren't exactly rejected. The book, is it actually banned? Can I say that? Or it just is?
I think the book is soft banned. I mean, there's an official list of banned books as far as I'm aware, but we've had a translation for about 7 or 8 years, and we can't get permission to publish the actual
Right.
Translation.
The book is really well known in Vietnam, that's for sure. Everyone I talked to knew it, but it's not officially published in Vietnam. So it's complicated, and we weren't officially banned either from shooting in Vietnam, but there was a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of... it was going to take time. They made that very clear. And so the fortunate thing is Thailand is very well structured. It has a lot of... equipment and crew and experience shooting shows this size. So it was not easy duplicating Saigon in Bangkok. We had to go to a lot of smaller cities trying to find period-looking buildings and buildings that had at least suggested a colonial background, which Thailand doesn't have. So it was not easy, actually, and it took a lot of work. But I'm pretty proud of the results, actually.
And then what was it like? I'm fascinated with the choreography, not only between you two, but also Director Park, and like right. What that experience was like. So you all met at the hotel, you got that together, you assembled the writer's room. Yeah. Talk me through very simple terms of like how you all actually worked together.
It's complicated. I'm not even sure how we did it. I mean, I had worked with Park Chan-wook before this. I had written a feature script with him a long time ago.
Besides being a director and so on, obviously he's a storyteller.
Yeah.
He writes the scripts. And so he's very interested in the details of all the different things about character, plot, setting, and all that. So he had an active role.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to be clear, he loved the book. I knew that from the first time I talked to him. He was excited. And it was the kind of thing that he said he's wanted to do but hasn't given. And he loved that he loved the sort of irreverence and the fact that it was an immigrant story, which he responded to, but not in a sentimental way that he was used to. He said it had a lot of scripts already that were in that milieu, but not to his taste. So he was very enthusiastic right from the beginning.
Yeah, I think taste is important.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm a big fan of Park Chan-wook's work before he came into my life. And his movie Old Boy was a stylistic influence on The Sympathizer. And then I saw Handmaiden well after The Sympathizer was published. And I thought, wow, the visual language that he has, the spectacular imagery that he deploys, and his understanding of history, colonialism, yeah, politics, mm-hmm, warfare, imperialism. I mean, this is the word he used.
Yeah.
We did an interview together for the Emmys, and someone asked him, well, what drew you to this book? And he said, you can draw parallels between Korea and Vietnam in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And he used the word imperialism.
He was in, you know? Yeah, to be honest, that it wasn't until he was involved that I really thought I could see the voice of the book being translated onto screen. It immediately made sense to me. Because of his politics, and just his style, his sort of fearlessness. So yeah, I thought, okay, that makes sense to me.
I mean, when you're talking about style and aesthetics, one of the things that stuck out to me is the editing and the storytelling in reverse, the storytelling in present and future projecting as well. And I would just love to talk about that from like those decisions that were being made, obviously in the book, but also like stylistically what we see on visually.
Oh, right, yeah, it's hard to remember when that came up. I mean, the book does go back and forth in time, like most books do, most novels do. We had to find a way to do that was cinematic, It's harder. It's easy in a book just to, in a sentence or two, find yourself back in time. But in a movie, it's harder. So we came up with this sort of filmic idea, this sort of rewind idea that he's almost editing his story. So he's kind of a filmmaker, which sort
yeah.
of put us on our level. And then I think at the very beginning in the first episode, we wanted people to question why he was starting where he was. He's told to start there by his interrogator. And it's sort of, I don't want to give anything away, but it's sort of, well, we wanted the viewers to be thinking, well, why is he starting there? Why do they want him to start there? And hopefully that pays off.
And what's the significance in the story that continues to prevail itself? Because I still feel like the quote in the beginning.
All wars are fought twice.
Yeah, in battlefield.
First time on the battlefield, the second time in memory.
Yes. And that's like, that stuck out with me, but it also for me as a viewer, it prepared me for
right.
the going back, which is why I wanted to ask that question, because I was like, it was so thoughtful.
It is about memory too. It is about that, because it's about, I think one of the great things about the book, again, is that in a lot of Vietnam War themed things, it's really about the atrocities of war, that we've seen that, the absurdity of the American involvement. But this is really about the consequences of that and the sort of the legacy on these individuals, but also on their memories, you know, like that they're carrying with them. And that became really important thematically to us, that is, because that's the way the story is told, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's still present in their psyches. So we were very happy when we came up with that code. I mean, I think you suggested it actually, but
someone suggested maybe we need some kind of frame
yes.
to get the viewers
and yeah, yeah.
introduce them into this story. Because interestingly enough, even though the Vietnam War ended only about 50 years ago, that's ancient history
right.
for most people, right?
Yeah.
And so they needed just a few lines to try to orient the reader. I guess it worked.
Yeah,
it worked.
Yeah. No, I immediately, it set me up for when I did see it in that opening scene and throughout, which I was like, oh, stylistically and from an aesthetic perspective. Mm-hmm. Speaking of things unplanned, you were in an episode as well. I would love to hear a bit more about your unplanned cameo
yeah.
and one-liner. You're an actor now, too.
Yes, so yes. yes. Well, I think it's kind of a tradition to put the author into whatever the production is, you know, Stan Lee and John le Carré and so on. And so, yeah, I was told to show up. It was actually a really fun experience for me, although I didn't get the role that I wanted.
Okay.
I said I wanted.
Listen, this is it. This is it.
I said I want to be blown up, because that's the fate of the author in his own adaptation. But
yes.
No. They had a more sophisticated idea. So I'm cast as a photographer
yep.
in a restaurant scene mm-hmm. where I'm taking a photograph of the entire cast mm-hmm. Because it's a longevity banquet.
Yep.
And I was only supposed to go there and take the photo. And that took 2 days, because I had to get hair, makeup,
yep.
clothing,
yep.
And then show up and all day shoot for literally what was supposed to be
in action and cut.
Yeah, yeah. But I wasn't supposed to say anything. And then Director Park, so I realized how much improvisation takes place. Yes. And Director Park was like, well, when do we should have you speak a line? We were like, I think you wrote it on the spur of the moment.
Yeah.
The line was. But it was like, turn on the mirror. Can someone turn on the mirror ball, please?
Or turn off the mirror
turn
ball.
Turn off the mirror ball?
Yeah.
Okay,
so see, you forgot you're on it.
See?
That's how it's done. And smile. I think you also said
and
smile.
And smile, right. Which we thought was I think
cool
most of that
and ironic.
Was cut out.
Yeah, it was
I think
smile.
It's like
yep.
3/4 of a second that I show up. But nevertheless, I spoke, so therefore they had to pay me. I
yes.
had to check for that.
Yes.
Can you believe it?
Yeah. Now he's
now
going
that
to be.
I'm thinking we should have just blown you up at the end of the scene.
That would have been boring. Just blows up.
I mean, you can't speak about the cast without speaking about the incredible cast. And yeah. and I believe Captain played, or I want to say interviewed, but didn't interview, auditioned
yeah.
for about nine months.
Yeah.
And then he got like a casual Zoom call with you. He was like, oh yeah, you got it. Like, yeah. tell me about like that process and when you all knew that he was the person.
I mean, it's a big role.
Yeah.
He really does carry this series. Like in the book, it's from his perspective. He was in every day except for one. And in that day, there was an actor playing him as a child.
So, yes.
So he is really in all over it. So we knew we had to get someone really good. And it's a difficult also because he has to be like a movie star, be charismatic,
yeah.
kind of spy, like a 70s male spy from Hollywood, except Vietnamese. And he also had to show him vulnerability. It's quite a huge acting range if you see the whole thing. So we auditioned him a lot of times. I know he's out there telling the world how we tortured him. And it's probably true. We really did, because we auditioned him. He's from Australia.
Yes.
He sent in his tape to a casting agent several times. We flew him to Korea to meet with Park Chan-wook. We flew him to L.A. to meet the two of us. He still didn't have the part.
Yes.
And then you're right. I gave him a Zoom at the end. I was really happy. He said, let me do it.
And, yeah, yeah.
And he's amazing, you know.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible how he characters. Yeah. How he... And
now that I see him, I don't know why it took us so long, but of course we had to have everyone on board.
I think it's very meta because, as you know from the very first few minutes of the first episode, he's being tortured.
Yes.
Or he's being interrogated.
Yeah.
He's constantly being asked to repeat, revise, get over to the satisfaction of his interrogator. Yes.
Yeah.
I did say in that final Zoom call when I gave him the part, I said, remember how you feel now? Because you can use that as a sense memory.
Yes.
You know, like, yeah.
But I mean, I feel like you're right. The range that he played, you know, the relationships that he had, his own family complexities, identity and duality, and then him having to like go to America, but like not want to go to America, but kind of always wanted to go to America, like all of these different nuances that played in. I mean, in the incredible Robert Downey Jr., the Academy Award winning Robert Downey Jr. playing multiple roles. Like, was he always going to play multiple roles from the beginning? Did that develop as, like, how? Just give me anything.
That was all Park Chan-wook.
Yeah.
I mean, literally at that meeting where he suggested different things to do to my
novel.
At
that dinner, was it? I think it might have been. That dinner at your house.
So then he said, oh, look, what if we made one white guy play all the white guys? And everyone was like, wow, that's a stroke of genius.
Yeah.
I like that.
Like, we discussed it before. He didn't come up accidentally. And we were a little afraid that what Vio would say.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a kind of crazy idea.
Captain, we were hoping you'd help us
by helping his new movie
to ensure its cultural integrity.
Yeah, yeah, what he said.
Act as an interpreter of sorts, a mediator between the two worlds, Oriental and Occidental.
The general speaks so highly of you, Captain. The half and half will give 100% to do whatever is necessary.
Right now, what seems necessary is to demand an apology for the insult I just received.
Cool you just, kid. There's no apology coming. But I am going to give you the opportunity of your fucking life.
I don't take an opportunity over an apology 8 days a week.
Doesn't sound like such a bad deal. Looks like we just sealed the deal there.
We loved it because we felt there were these recurrent older patriarchal American white guys in the captain's life in the book, and they come up almost as a sort of motif. They're all very different. Yep. They're all very different ideologically, but at one point in the book they are all literally represented as all in the same club.
Yeah,
you know, they're all, and we wanted to show that that's not an accident, that there's a similarity, that they're all complicit in a way, and that they're all working together in some way, even though even more than they understand. So he came up with this idea of making it one actor and making that sort of the thematic point. And there's also a sort of psychological point that comes up as the episode continues, how the captain perceives them all and how he deals with them all. So he suggested the idea to me, and I was like, that's amazing, but let's see what Viet thinks.
Incredible performance there. And one of the things going back to Captain is, I believe, Hao Zhande is, he didn't speak, he's Australian, but he didn't speak Vietnamese. And so then he was like in a crash course to like learn, talk to me about that process. Because you said, it was important to be able to center Vietnamese actors speaking Vietnamese.
It's part of the casting process, and you know, we have to look at history here.
Yeah.
I mean, we have 4 million. There's 90 million people in Vietnam, 4 million Vietnamese people in the diaspora, and the reason they're there is because of the war and the aftermath. And you know, you're doing the global search for actors and everything, and the criteria is pretty specific. They have to be Vietnamese origin of some kind, and they have to be fluent in English, and they have to be able to speak Vietnamese, and they have to be the right age, which for the Blood Brothers is around their early 30s. Mm-hmm. That really narrows your pool down.
Yeah.
And then in Vietnam itself, I think we couldn't audition a lot of actors because a lot of them did not want to audition.
Why is...
Well, because being associated with this show, because of the sort of reputation of the book, could harm their
livelihood.
Right. But the reality is, for this diasporic generation, like, you know, I think Fred, who plays Bone, and Hua, who plays
another great actor.
Yeah,
amazing. Right. Great. Yeah.
But they're American. They're born in America, the United States, and Australia.
Yeah.
Right? And so, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, Canadian. Sorry. In fact, none of the Blood Brothers are American.
Right.
Three, who plays Mutt, is also Canadian, also from Vietnam. So yeah, I mean, the basic reality is this entire generation that's been born outside of the country, oftentimes their Vietnamese is shaky to non-existent.
Right. Right.
That's just the reality that we had to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the lingo, like, it was almost like I had to really understand it, not just like the really understand how to be able to communicate there.
No, you're right. It's not casual Vietnamese. Yes. He's got to talk about war.
Yes.
Specific terms and communist. Yeah. Lingo kind of, he's good. So yeah, it's not casual chatty.
Yeah.
Vietnamese. Yeah. Yeah.
So we had a lot of people working on the Vietnamese aspect. I think it's at least two or three people on the set. At least one person working on the script offset.
Yes.
My former Vietnamese language professor, was consulting after everything was done in the ADR.
Yeah.
There was at least a dozen Vietnamese actors on the ADR trying to do things after the shooting was finished.
Yeah. And plus Vietnamese continuity person, Vietnamese editor. So we, you know, like at every level, we had people watching and scrutinizing. He did speak some Vietnamese, but not a lot, right?
And not enough for the full breadth of what the role required.
Work hard.
What would be success for you, for both of you, for this show? I mean, because like as a viewer, success for me is seeing the different range of perspectives, but I'm curious what success means.
Well, I'm sure from HBO's point of view, it has to be about metrics.
Of course, of course.
For me, it was a triumph already just to get the show made.
Yeah.
Okay, we somehow persuaded HBO to put up as much money as it did to make this show, and now it's out there.
Yeah.
And now you have a show that's, I think, around a 90% Vietnamese cast speaking a lot of Vietnamese words, talking about one Vietnamese perspective.
Yeah.
And that's really important to emphasize, okay?
Yeah.
Like, there will be some Vietnamese people who disagree with the show, and they should, because how can one story tell all of this diversity of Vietnamese points of view? But the point is, my version of success would be that this show is a lever, and that it opens further opportunities for more Asian and Vietnamese actors and storytellers in front of the camera, behind the camera, to tell even further stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the show is also about how ideologies sort of calcify and end up alienating people, even though they have noble aspirations at the beginning. And I feel if the show can create a discussion among people and sort of break down some of those boundaries, allow people to empathize across these received separations. Maybe it's just a bit of a vague triumph, but I feel like if it can create that kind of discussion, allow people to imagine themselves on the other side of war, recognizes another story there that is just as valid. I think that kind of response is really what I dream for, both within the Vietnamese community and certainly outside it too, you know.
Especially after, like you said, 50 years.
And yeah.
Then, but 50 years of a story being told one way.
Yes.
In media, which reaches, as we said, millions of people, to be able to say, hey, well, there's also this perspective.
Yes, hopefully for the current wars happening now, we don't have to wait 50 years before we start imagining the other side.
It's so cynical, you see.
Well, you know, much like this show, I want to start with you and end with you. To keep in theme.
No, you're right. He gets the first and the last word.
You've spoken a lot about just like historical context and trauma. And is it history or is it trauma? And you've also spoken very publicly about your mom and her experiences. What do you think she would view of this show and what she would think about it?
Wow, that's amazing.
Well, that's a great question. I'm reminded of the fact that when I won the Pulitzer Prize, for example, I didn't actually tell my parents. Yeah, because I was like, oh, this is what you're supposed to do, right?
Yeah.
As the Asian kid or whatever. And so my dad called me the next day.
I'm sorry, but that's so different for me. My parents would have told me that I'd won.
They would
have won. But the next day I'm on the road after the announcement, my dad calls me.
Yeah.
And his voice is shaking with happiness.
Oh.
And he says, the villagers in Vietnam called. you won the Pulitzer Prize.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, all I had to do was win the Pulitzer Prize.
Yes, finally.
Yeah. So I think the same thing. It's like, I don't think he ever read the novel. Why would I want to, like, my parents sacrificed so much, and now I'm going to make them read my work?
Yeah.
That's important. But
yeah.
He takes great satisfaction from my sales figures and my awards.
Yeah.
That's cool. So I think with the TV show, the same thing. I don't know if they would want to watch it or if they could watch it. I think it would reawaken certain kinds of difficult memories for them, as it has for a certain Vietnamese spectators of the show. But I think they would be enormously proud of the spectacle of the show itself.
Yeah.
That here it is, you know, we one version of our story is finally getting told on one of the biggest stages available to us as Vietnamese refugees, Vietnamese Americans, Vietnamese people. I think she would have been proud.
Oh, now we've got to win more awards for his parents.
Yep, we got to do it. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
All right, that's our episode for today. We weren't that rusty.
No.
We got back into the swing of things, right?
Yeah, it only takes a little bit.
Please subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast or wherever you watch your podcast, and join us next week for a new episode.